Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Ausgabe unserer Reihe Wörterbuch der Gegenwart, die heute Abend dem Thema Angst gewidmet ist. Besonders begrüßen möchte ich unsere Redner Sinan Antun, Alan Feldman und Josef Vogel und mich gleichzeitig für ihre Teilnahme ganz herzlich bedanken. Bedanken möchte ich mich auch bei meinen Kolleginnen Olga von Schubert und Stefan Auer. Dem Begriff der Angst liegt eine besondere Art der Ambivalenz zugrunde. Diese Ambivalenz zeigt sich bereits in der Existenzphilosophie Søren Kierkegaards. Auf der einen Seite beraubt die Angst nämlich nach Kierkegaard den Menschen der Freiheit, macht ihn unfrei. Gleichzeitig ist sie aber auch eine Grundbedingung menschlicher Freiheit. Nur wer frei ist zu wählen, ist mit der Angst konfrontiert. Sie ist damit eine Voraussetzung menschlicher Subjektivität und Individualität. Die Möglichkeit zur Wahl setzt zumindest eine partielle Loslösung von sozialen und natürlichen Zwängen voraus. Kierkegaard, der gegen das Denkgebäude Hegels die subjektive Erfahrung des Einzelnen in Anschlag bringt, artikuliert damit eine Ambivalenz, die in der Evolutionsbiologie des 20. Jahrhunderts in einem völlig veränderten Wissenschaftskontext auftritt. Gemäß der Evolutionsbiologie kommt der Angst in der Entwicklung des Menschen nämlich eine wichtige Schutzfunktion zu. Sie erlaubt es, in Gefahrensituationen angemessen zu handeln, indem neue Handlungsoptionen erkannt werden. Sie wird aber dysfunktional, wenn zu viel Angst Handeln blockiert oder zu wenig Angst die realen Gefahren nicht erkennen lässt. Vor diesem Hintergrund erscheint es besonders interessant, sich die Rolle der Angst beim Übergang von der industriellen zur postindustriellen Gesellschaft anzusehen, wie sie etwa Ulrich Beck im Kontext seiner Überlegungen zur Risikogesellschaft thematisiert. Die Risikogesellschaft ist nach Beck nicht eine Option, die bewusst gewählt wurde, sondern sie entsteht quasi natürlich, dadurch, dass an den Selbstverständlichkeiten der Industriegesellschaft, wie Fortschrittsdenken, Abstraktion von ökologischen Folgen und Gefahren, Kontrolloptimismus einfach und das heißt folgenblind festgehalten wird. Gleichzeitig ändert sich aber der Orientierungsrahmen. Ging es in der Industriegesellschaft nach Beck noch darum, Gleichheit zwischen Klassen herzustellen, geht es in der Risikogesellschaft um Sicherheit. War in der Klassengesellschaft die treibende Kraft der Satz "Ich habe Hunger", kennzeichnet die Risikogesellschaft die Aussage "Ich habe Angst". Dies ist eine diffuse Angst, eine Angst angesichts der Entwicklung des gesamtgesellschaftlichen Systems, also nicht eine Angst, die Handlungsoptionen freisetzt, sondern sehr schnell paranoid werden kann. Das hat damit zu tun, dass sich Einzelne wie Gruppen zunehmend als Objekt von Entwicklungen und nicht mehr als ihre Akteure verstehen. Da sie im Sinne Becks an den alten Kategorien der Industriegesellschaft festhalten, liegt die Zukunft nicht mehr vor, sondern hinter ihnen. Was Becks Analyse auf jeden Fall deutlich macht, ist, dass das Phänomen der Angst von grundlegender Bedeutung ist, um die Umbruchprozesse und Verwerfungen in unseren heutigen Gesellschaften zu verstehen. Und damit komme ich zu den heutigen Rednern, die sich dem Phänomen der Angst aus unterschiedlichen disziplinären, aber auch gesellschaftlichen Perspektiven nähern. Zunächst wird Sinan Antun das Gespräch eröffnen. Sinan Antun ist Dichter, Schriftsteller, Übersetzer und verortet sich mit seinen Arbeiten zwischen klassischer und moderner arabischer Lyrik und Prosa sowie Postcolonial Theory und aktueller politischer Analyse. Er lehrt als Associate Professor an der New York University und ist in diesem Jahr Stipendiat am Wissenschaftskolleg in Berlin. Sinan Antun wurde in Bagdad geboren. Er studierte englische Literatur an der Universität in der irakischen Hauptstadt. Nach dem Golfkrieg 1991 zog er in die USA, wo er sein Studium in Georgetown und an der Harvard University fortsetzte. 2006 promovierte er in arabischer Literatur mit einer Dissertation über den islamischen Dichter und Gelehrten aus dem 10. Jahrhundert Ibn al-Hayyaj. Zu seinen wissenschaftlichen Werken zählen The Poetics of the Obscene sowie Artikel zu Mahmoud Darwish, Sargon Boulous, Saadi Youssef. Sinan ist Mitglied des Editorial Review Board des Arab Studies Journal und Mitbegründer und Herausgeber des Online-Portals Jalaliyah. Anton hat 2 Gedichtbände bisher vorgelegt und 4 Romane, die in 12 Sprachen veröffentlicht wurden. Das Motiv der Angst ist ein wiederkehrendes Thema in seinen Arbeiten. In irakischer Rhapsodie ist es eine eindringliche Atmosphäre, der junge Protagonist unter dem brutalen Überwachungssystem von Saddam Hussein in Irak ausgesetzt ist. Während in seinem Roman The Baghdad Eucharist die Angst vor Angehörigen religiöser Minderheiten im Mittelpunkt steht. Im vergangenen Jahr hat Sinan Antun ein Phänomen in einem Guardian-Artikel beschrieben, das auch hier Ausgangspunkt seines Beitrags sein wird. Die Angst vor der arabischen Sprache. Der 2. Redner ist Alan Feldman. Daran anknüpfend möchte ich ihn ganz herzlich begrüßen. Er ist Politik- und Kulturanthropologe an der New York University in New York. In seinen Forschungen beschäftigt er sich mit der Politisierung des Blicks, visueller Kultur der Gewalt, der politischen Archäologie von Medien und Technik. Er unterrichtete bereits an verschiedenen internationalen Universitäten. Alan Feldman analysiert die Zirkulation von Bildern von Gewalt und Terror in unserer visuellen Kultur. Die Darstellung von Gewalt entfaltet eine zerstörerische Kraft und wird auf brutale Weise produktiv. Feldman setzt sich intensiv mit einer Ethnographie der Gewalt, des Körpers und der Sinne auseinander. In diesem Zusammenhang analysiert er Formen technokratischer Gewaltakte und ihre visuellen Erscheinungsformen. Im Zentrum steht dabei die gesellschaftliche Wirkung durch die Konstruktion affektiver Commons. In seinem jüngsten Buch Archives of the Insensible, of War, Photopolitics and Dead Memory von 2016 hinterfragt Alan Feldman das Verhältnis zwischen gegenwärtigen Formen des Krieges, Gerechtigkeit, Menschenrechte und Demokratie mit politischer Gewalt. Welche sind die physischen, symbolischen und strukturellen Formen und Vorstellungen von Souveränität, an denen sich politische Macht ausrichtet? In seinem heutigen Beitrag zeigt er, wie die Verschleierung und das Unsichtbarmachen von Gewalt und Terror einen konstanten wie latenten Angstzustand in unseren Gesellschaften erzeugt. Zum Schluss wird Josef Vogel sprechen. Josef Vogel muss man in Berlin eigentlich gar nicht lange vorstellen. Viele der Anwesenden hier kennen ihn. Er ist Professor für neuere deutsche Literatur, in den Kulturwissenschaften und Medien an der Humboldt-Universität in Berlin. Außerdem ist er Permanent Visiting Professor an der Princeton University. Seine Forschungsschwerpunkte liegen in der Geschichte und Theorie des Wissens, der Geschichte von Gefahr und Gefährlichkeit in der Neuzeit, der Diskurs- und Medientheorie sowohl der Literaturgeschichte des 18. bis 20. Jahrhunderts. Zuletzt erschien von ihm der Souveränitätseffekt und das Gespenst des Kapitals. Vogel war Initiator des DFG-Netzwerks Spielformen der Angst, das von 2009 bis 2011 dauerte, das sich bereits vor 5 Jahren mit der Angstkonjunktur im Kontext aktueller Gesellschaftsdebatten beschäftigt hat. Das Projekt fragt danach, wie Ängste aus der kollektiven Ebene konstruiert, kommuniziert und reflektiert werden, welche diskursiven Strategien der Dynamisierung, Steuerung und Beschleunigung zu beobachten sind. Josef Vogel hat sich intensiv mit der Figur des Amokläufers auseinandergesetzt. In seiner Analyse verweist er auf eine Facette der Angst vor dem Irregulären und Nicht-Erklärbaren, die in den sogenannten Zeiten des Terrors eine erschreckende Aktualität erfährt. Wir freuen uns heute Abend, mehr von ihm zu erfahren über die Bedeutung von Angst als Regierungsinstrument und über ihre politische Verwertung. Insgesamt freuen wir uns auf alle 3 Vorträge. In Anschluss daran werden wir hier gemeinsam diskutieren und natürlich haben Sie die Möglichkeit, aus dem Publikum Fragen und Anmerkungen zu machen. Herzlich willkommen nochmal Josef Vogel, Sinan Antun und Alan Feldman. Wir beginnen mit Sinan Antun.
Thank you, Mr. Shearer, for the introduction, and thank you for the organizers, especially Stefan, for his patience with my tardiness in answering emails. And thank you all for coming, of course. My remarks today will be in two parts. The first is about what I call Monstrum Arabicus, and the second will be a reading of two poems and an excerpt from my novel. So, the expansive and majestic encyclopedia of 21st century monsters, compiled by a group of leading scholars and experts, is still a work in progress and has yet to be published. Not much is known about its methodology and scope, but we know for sure that one of its entries is dedicated to Monstrum Arabicus. Although medieval-sounding and seemingly fictitious, this being/monster is alive and well in our present moment. Even if its sightings are very rare, its traces can be easily detected in various sites and moments on a global scale. The fear it generates is visceral and considerable, as I will try to demonstrate in my remarks. It is not easy to provide a description or an illustration of the shape of Monstrum Arabicus, as it is quite elusive and shape-shifting. But one can safely say that it has 28 tentacles, and they are identical to the letters of the Arabic alphabet. What you see is just an approximation. And this was, if you have not realized, a kind of playful Borgesian introduction to my subject. How long has this monster been in existence? This question cannot be answered easily or in a satisfactory manner. Its genealogy is complicated and a matter of debate. However, I contend that while it has existed for a long time, the 9/11 moment and the now permanent war on terror and its discourse engendered a metamorphosis through which Monstrum Arabicus became what it is today. The 9/11 attacks were officially framed in cultural and civilizational terms, rather than as an event with a genealogy better understood in terms of geopolitics and recent history. That, of course, would have entailed a critical look at U.S. and Western foreign policy and the costs and consequences of alliances with brutal regimes and support for sacred wars against evil empires. Actually, just 2 weeks ago, and this bears mentioning, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, died. His death reminded many of us of his decisive role in theorizing and encouraging jihad, as I like it, when jihad was cool and was not evil. An old clip resurfaced last month where he addresses a group of Afghani jihadists telling them, quote, "God is on your side." You can find it on YouTube. A year or so later, Ronald Reagan received jihadists, bearded, turbaned, Muslim Afghani men in the Oval Office and compared them to the founding fathers of the United States because they were freedom fighters. So rather than wasting a lot of time and effort in debating Islamic theology, one simply, not so simply, has to just look at these 20 years and what happened. That, I assure you, will provide a better understanding of the roots of jihad. Now, thanks to an already established and powerful archive of Orientalism, whatever that entails in a way of this look at a monolithical culture that is largely static in the past and so on and so forth, thanks to that powerful archive, which has its potent effects and practices, a monolithic Islam could, once again, after 9/11, be invoked and used to easily and efficiently reduce multiple and complicated categories, histories, identities, and being all into one. And here's another nicer illustration, of course, of the Monstrum Arabicus. This being a clash of civilizations and cultures, culture itself, no matter how difficult it is to frame culture, became a permanent crime scene that had to be better demarcated and understood. Arabic, the language of Islam's scripture, the lingua franca of the classical period of Islamic civilizations, and the one used by the terrorists, was deemed a language of what I call forensic interest. If not outright, it was criminalized in a way. Government and corporate resources in the U.S. were increased and channeled to train linguists and create and sustain experts on Islam. Monstrum Arabicus, of course, feeds on Monstrum Islamicus. And needless to say, the two are often conflated and interchangeable. And also Muslims and Arabs are often conflated and interchangeable. One detects also a general paradox in the rush to decode, translate, and create strategic knowledge. On the one hand, the core of this culture of terrorism must be penetrated and mastered. The codes of the essence must be broken. A futile and impossible enterprise, of course, since there is no essence. On the other hand, the core must also somehow remain unattainable and ultimately undecipherable. The combined effect of these two is a constant policing of fictitious boundaries that reproduce the logic of cultural clash, war, and struggle. This is consonant with the logic of the permanent war on terror, a war that produces the conditions that create more of what it purports to destroy. So in other terms, the simultaneous desire to translate and decode and the desire to keep at bay or to assign to untranslatability. If all of this sounds a bit too abstract, I will provide a few examples to support what I'm saying. I should say, of course, that the logic and practices of the war on terror have been generalized and normalized across the globe with variations by various regimes. The first example is the curious untranslatability of Allah, which is something that I noticed as soon as I arrived in the United States in 1991, but I think that after 9/11, it acquires more importance. The signifier Allah in Arabic is the case in point. In various media, genres, and contexts, there is a resistance to translating the word and rendering it in English simply as God with a capital G. This, of course, would risk indicating the fact that Allah is merely the monotheistic God of the so-called Abrahamic religions. And this would encroach on some important boundaries and squander the alien quality and effect of a word left untranslated and then untranslatable. Another example is the curious untranslatability of the dialogues of terrorists, and they are predominantly Muslim and Arab in many films. While even the most despicable and monstrous characters of serial killers and other hideous villains get the permission to narrate and speak, the dialogue of terrorists is often left untranslated, or it isn't in any recognizable language, merely barbarous sounds of kh, for example. Admittedly, this is the case often in blockbuster films, but even in the Munich film by Spielberg, everyone's dialogue is translated, but the terrorists, for some reason, the audience doesn't need to know what they're saying. Now, more recent examples, I'm sure you know about them, is this the removal of passengers uttering Arabic words on flights in the United States, or passengers wearing T-shirts that have the Arabic script on it. Another important example from my hometown of New York City, in terms of another example of the sense of danger that Arabic generates. In 2007, There were plans to open a bilingual Arabic-English public school in New York City. That was greeted with suspicion and active opposition for fear that such a school might become a hotbed of radicalism and indoctrination. It also says something about this, the potency of Arabic in and of itself. Mere exposure to the Arabic language would potentially turn people into terrorists. Even though in New York City there are dozens of dual language schools that teach Spanish, French, Mandarin Chinese, and Haitian Creole, and so on and so forth. None of these schools, of course, generate even a fraction of the controversy that this Arabic school has. Another notorious example was that in the usually colleges have, universities choose a book for the incoming freshman class to read. And I think it was in 2005 when the University of North Carolina chose a translation into English of the Quran for the students to read. And there was, again, another huge controversy because the parents were afraid that if their children read the Quran, God knows what's going to happen to them. So anyway, the last example, it's different in that, this again, the forensic interest in the culture, which happens at many levels, in that The New Yorker, one of the premier cultural journals in the country, which rarely has any interest in modern Arabic poetry, publishes an article by two scholars entitled Battle Lines. One to understand the jihadists? Read their poetry. So I quote this from the article. Al-Qaeda and other Islamist movements produce a huge amount of verse. The vast majority of it circulates online in a clandestine network of social media accounts, mirror sites, and proxies, which appear and disappear with bewildering speed, thanks to surveillance and hacking. On militant websites, poetry discussion forums feature couplets on current events, competitions among poets who try to outdo one another in virtuosic feats, and downloadable collections with scholarly accoutrements, and so on and so forth. So the key sentence, analysts have generally ignored these texts as if poetry were a colorful but ultimately distracting byproduct of jihad. But this is a mistake. It is impossible, these two major scholars from very prestigious universities tell us, it is impossible to understand jihadism, its objectives, its appeal for new recruits, and its durability without examining its culture. Now, as a poet and as a scholar of poetry, I actually think it's quite the opposite. This is one case where actually we can do away and no need to understand jihadism. Just as with the examples I mentioned above, one needs to look at geopolitical history and foreign affairs rather than looking at some kind of essence. And this happening in this being written in 2016 is one example of going back to old and traditional Orientalist ideas. Now, there is much more to say, but I don't have a lot of time. But this is the case that I want to make. And this has major consequences, of course. And we can talk about that in the Q&A. Now, the second part is, as the introduction said, is that unfortunately, I lived 23 years in a country that suffered from dictatorship, but afterwards actually suffered the consequences of the war on terror. Because the 2003 invasion of Iraq is a product of the discourse of the war on terror. And whatever one may say about dictatorship of Saddam Hussein, and I've written a lot about it, we were talking about this now, the invasion also exposed Iraq to international terrorism and ended up destroying an already fragile society. And so sadly, or unfortunately, a lot of my writing, of course, has to do with themes about what happens to this society and the civil war that is suffered. So I'll read one poem, which is called An Ordinary Day, and then an excerpt from a novel. It was an ordinary day, except my father was very late. My mother screamed when she opened the door. He was headless, his clothes smeared with blood. He hugged her to calm her down, but she kept crying. He said he wouldn't be able to watch TV with us anymore. we would never eat together again. He gave my little brother his pillow, asked us to listen to mother and to do our homework. Then he knelt to pray, thanking God for what was left. My little sister cried a lot. Then she beheaded her doll and buried its head in our backyard. Now, the excerpt I'm going to read is from a novel called The Pomegranate Alone in the original Arabic. In the English, it's called The Corpse Washer. So about a person who is born into a family of traditional corpse washers, but he has artistic tendencies and rebels against his father and wants to become an artist, but dictatorship, economic collapse, and sanctions, and then the war force him to do the very same profession that he tried to run away from. And in the civil war that ensued after the American invasion, there was a massive killing, of course, so the bodies pile up. He makes a lot of money, but his daily life is, and his psyche is traumatized. So this is just in the opening section. She is lying naked on her back on a marble bench in an open place with no walls or ceilings. There is no one around and nothing in sight except sand, which reached all the way to the horizon, where clouds crowded the sky and blocked the sun by turns before rushing out of sight. I too was naked, barefoot, dumbfounded by everything around me. I can feel the sand under my feet and a cool wind. I move slowly toward the bench. When and why has she come back after all these years? Her long black hair is piled about her head. A few locks cover her right cheek, as if guarding her face, which has not changed with the years. Her eyebrows are carefully plucked, and her eyelids, which ended in thick eyelashes, were shut. Her nose guards her lips, which bear pink lipstick on them as if she were still alive. Her nipples are erect, and there is no trace of the surgery. Her hands are clasped over her navel. Her fingernails and toenails are painted the same pink as her lipstick. I wonder whether she is asleep or dead. I am afraid to touch her. I look into her face and whisper her name, Reem. She smiles, her eyes still shut first. Then she opens them, and the blackness in her pupils smiles as well. I can't grasp what is going on. I ask in a loud voice, Reem, what are you doing here? I am about to hug and kiss her, but she warns me, don't kiss me. Wash me first so we can be together. What, are you still alive? Wash me so we can be together. I missed you so much. But you are not dead. Wash me, darling, wash me so we can be together. With what? There is nothing here. Wash me. Raindrops begin to fall and she closes her eyes. I wipe a drop off her nose with my index finger. Her skin is warm, which means she was alive. I start to caress her hair. I will wash her with the rain, I think. She smiles as if she'd heard my thought. Another drop settles above her left eyebrow. I wipe it off. I think I hear the sound of a car approaching. I turn around and see a Humvee driving at an insane speed, leaving a trail of flying dust. It suddenly swerves to the right and comes to a stop a few meters away. Its doors open. Masked men wearing khaki uniforms and carrying machine guns rush toward us. I try to shield Dream with my right hand, but one of the men has already reached me. He hits me in the face with the stock of his machine gun. I fall to the ground. He kicks me in the stomach. Another starts dragging me away from the washing bench. None of them say a word. I am screaming and cursing them, but I can't hear myself. The two men force me to get down on my knees and tie my wrists with a wire behind my neck. One of them puts a knife to my neck. The other blindfolds me. I try to run away, but they hold me tightly. I scream again, but cannot hear my screams. I can only hear Reem's shrieks, the laughter and the grunts of the men, and the sound of the rain. I feel a sharp pain, then the cold blade of the knife penetrating my neck. Hot blood spills over my chest and back. My head falls to the ground and rolls like a ball on the sand. I hear footsteps. One of the men takes off my blindfold and shoves it in his pocket. He spits in my face and goes away. I see my body to the left of the bench, kneeling in a puddle of blood. The other men return to the Humvee, two of them dragging Reem by her arms. She tries to turn her head back in my direction, but one of them slaps her. I cry out her name, but cannot hear my voice. They put her in the back seat and shut the door. The engine starts. The Humvee speeds away and disappears. The rain keeps falling on the empty bench. I woke up panting and sweating. I wiped my forehead and face. The same nightmare had been recurring for weeks now, with minor changes. Sometimes I see Reem's severed head on the bench and hear her voice saying, "Wash me, darling." But this was the first time there was rain. It must have slipped through from outdoors. I could hear drops on the window. I look at my watch. It's already 3:30 a.m. I've only slept 3 hours after a very long day. Death is not content with what it takes from me in my waking hours. It insists on haunting me even in my sleep. Isn't it enough that I toil all day, tending to its eternal guests, preparing them to sleep in its lap? Is death punishing me because I thought I could escape? If my father were still alive, he would mock me and my silly thoughts. He would dismiss all of this as infantile, unbecoming to a man. Didn't he spend a lifetime doing his job day after day, never once complaining of death? But death back then was timid and more measured than today. I can almost hear death saying, "I am what I am and haven't changed at all. I am but a postman." If death is a postman, then I am one of those who receive his letters every day. I am the one who reopens them carefully from their bloodied and torn envelopes. I am the one who washes them, who removes the stamps of death, and dries and perfumes them, mumbling what I don't entirely believe in. Then I wrap them carefully in white so they may reach their final reader, the grave. But letters are piling up, Father. Tenfold more than what you used to see in the span of a week now pass before me in one day. If you were alive, Father, would you say that this is fate and God's will? I wish you were here so I could leave Mother with you and escape without feeling guilty. You were heavily armed with faith, and that made your heart a fortified castle. My heart, by contrast, is an abandoned house whose windows are shattered and doors unhinged. Ghosts play inside and the winds wail. Thank you.
I too will talk about war in a way as a postal system. I'd like to thank Haus der Kulturen der Welt for their invitation and gracious hospitality here in Berlin. Thinking through the relation between power and fear has often paired affect with virtualization, which tracks fear from material genesis to immaterial mimesis. In Korjev's reading of the Hegelian dialectic of subjugating recognition, the sovereign or master represents the fear of death for another who becomes the living archive and subjugated organ of that terror, the Hegelian slave or bondsman. The Hegelian master requires a politics of transmissibility. The master capitalizes risk and death in combat to win recognition from the subjugated other as the enjoyment of symbolic profit in the form of labor service by the slave. Writing in the same pre-war period as Korzhev, Simone Weil describes the promissory structure of virtualized fear in war. She writes, quote, "It will surely kill, or it will possibly kill, or perhaps it merely hangs over the being it can kill at any and every moment. It turns man into stone. From the power of transforming a man into a thing proceeds another power, otherwise prodigious, the power of turning a man into a thing while he is still alive. He is alive, he has a soul, and yet he is a thing. Still breathing, he is nothing but matter. Still thinking, he can think nothing." End quote. I suggest that new forms of executive power are reworking affective, phobogenic power through virtualizing regimes of insensibility, inferred by Weil's reference to de-subjectification and thinghood. Consider the use of sensory deprivation regimes in torture, in fear-provoking torture. I term this regime of insensibility cultural anesthesia, the expulsion of sensory experience that engenders a politics of dematerialization of force. The interdiction of an embodied and common sensorium with the capacity to speak truth to power. Such sensory stratification and deletion prepares the socio-cultural conditions of political apperception, the violence of blanking out violence that minimalizes the collective capacity for its public witness, seditious recirculation, and de-justification. The facticity of justified and mediatic war originates in a falsification that institutes the ontological difference between factuality and actuality, barricading the former from the excessive dissonances of the latter. To propose the orchestrated disjuncture between factuality and actuality is not to arrive at a determining, uncontestable ground beyond masking ideologies, but rather it is to explore that fissure in itself as a generative power that proceeds by way of the essential, needful, and designed accident and catastrophe from which surplus political value is extracted. And I'll be talking about the insensibility of the accident or the catastrophe. We are living the time of wartime as a time out of time, as a fall out of conventional time that fractures any militarized idea of progress. Jacques Derrida names such temporal dislocation the contretemps, which is poorly translated by the English term accident and better glossed as counter time. Simultaneously inessential, rigorous necessity, and catastrophic disruption, the possibility and actuality of the accident as a counter time is a conditioning radical contingency of all proper and programmed temporality, such as war, law, securitization, and democracy. A contretemps recently befell democracy in the United States in the coming to power of a counterfactual presidency. It's but a brief slide from the contretemps of phobogenic, absentee Iraqi WMDs whose fabulation justified invasion to the current countertime of presidential rules by alternative facts with a phobia of actuality. The contretemps carries the formative sense of a mishap as a blow to the body. The phrase a contretemps, originally a 17th century category of fencing and combat, diversely signifies an inopportune moment, movement of a weapon, a false time, a motion out of time, an unexpected and untoward event, a reversal, a random but intervening occurrence, and being in countertime. Allumage a contretemps is a military term meaning cross-firing, when the state or the military shoots at itself. With the advent of the contretemps, the portentous breaks into our universe in the form of a parallel creation, a breach of procedure that disrupts extant moral order and social syntax, by accelerating the separation of monads, infinite distance, the disconnection of experiences, end quote, from Derrida. The historical experience of the contretemps disconnects internal time consciousness from the institutionalized metrics that compress social time and space into synchronized measure and meaning. Again, from Derrida, for there is no contretemps without the pledge, the vow of synchrony, the desired sharing of a living present, end quote. The contretemps does not achieve the status of a codified norm and is denied the stature of a legible action. In its anomic illegibility, the contretemps is the action of a non-action, a figure of occluded and encrypted significance within a computational regime which can prove determinate in the very last instance. The anachronic accident arrives as an a-causal effect whose causality has to be retrofitted ad seriatim from an abruptly emergent point of inception, the emergency zone triggered by the collision of system and event. In its radiating afterlife and afterimage, the wound of the consequential contretemps cannot be sutured. It unfolds as the elusive cause of the so-called cause, undermining our capacity to catch causality in the act. Werner Hamacher translates contretemps as Unzeit. This is, quote, I'm quoting Hamacher, the pre-possibility of all temporal possibilities that does not precede these within a time series. Rather, it precedes the latter as a non-linear, non-geometric, and non-metrical play of various times and time possibilities, end quote. The contretemps is the rupturing of a single and organized temporality of which justified war was once the highest expression. Paradoxically, the contretemps has emerged as a core principle of counterinsurgent rule under which war no longer fulfills or requires the normative tasks that have been historically assigned to it. Now, Derrida distinguishes the accidental contretemps, the singular accidentality of the accident, from the essential and needful contretemps. The latter is the calculated non-accidental accident. The essential accident as the time of war times manifests as the accidentalization of war. Accidentalization does not reduce war to haphazard mishap, though this is claimed by the ideology of excusable collateral damage. Rather, the needful or required contretemps infers the mobilization and politicization of the accidentalized. This accidentalization of the accident implies a deliberate action upon the accident as concept and event. The accident is placed under erasure, sur la tour, to signal its historical and semantic inoperability. In being retained in the discourse of war, beneath the mark of its defacement, the canceled and deferred concept of the accident signals a flashing emergency zone. A contretemps has befallen the accident in its historical and conceptual trajectory. As Jean-Luc Nancy observes of the Fukushima disaster, the essential accident, under the rule of capital, must be conceptualized as more than a catastrophe in its calculability and risk assessment, and as no more a catastrophe in functioning as a utilitarian algorithm for generating convertible surplus value through disaster accumulation. For Nancy, considering the commensuration of more than a catastrophe and no more a catastrophe, quote, it is this equivalence that is catastrophic. Consider the emigration of American forces from the confessed contretemps in Iraq to the good and necessary war in Afghanistan. The catastrophe of Iraq provisioned an alibi, which, of course, translates as elsewhere, provisioned an elsewhere of military political renewal in a stalemated Afghani war. When speaking mournfully, and here's another example, when speaking mournfully to CNN of the Gazan civilians killed by Israeli missile strikes in 2014, Netanyahu claimed, quote, "All civilian casualties are unattended by us, the Israelis, but actually intended by Hamas. They want to pile up as many civilian dead as they can because somebody, they said, I mean, it's gruesome, that they use telegenically dead Palestinians for their cause. They want the dead, the more, the better," end quote, from Netanyahu. In Netanyahu's phantasmagoria, each carefully launched Israeli missile exemplifies a ballistics of innocence in being subject to a mishap through its refunctioning by a Hamas imputedly committed to the mechanical reproduction of televisual Palestinian dead. The true violence of Gaza is cast in lead by Netanyahu as the self-enclosure of the agent and patient of force exclusively in the Palestinian body politic. Appearing under erasure, a quote from Solomon, J. Solomon, who was one of the inventors of camouflage in World War I. Quote, "Invisibility in everything is the thing we aim at in modern war," end quote. The accidentalization of war crimes is fully to the fore in the abduction of combatants and non-combatants in pogroms of enforced and disavowed disappearance. To think through such a claim is to step back in part from the worthy tomes of empirical data on enforced disappearance collated by human rights organizations that are merely the tip of an unquantifiable iceberg, and to consider the making of the missing as sustaining a phobogenic executive power. This is to render political disappearance irreducible to an extrinsic mishap that befalls the normalized proceduralism of the state and the law, and which can be rectified by the restoration of the latter. The UN Commission on Human Rights defines disappearance as, quote, "the arrest, detention, abduction, or any other form of deprivation of liberty by agents of the state or by persons or groups of persons acting with the authorization, support, or acquiescence of the state, followed by a refusal to acknowledge the deprivation of liberty or by concealment of the fate or whereabouts of the disappeared person, which place such a person outside the protection of the law," end quote. The modifiers enforced and involuntary applied to disappearance by human rights organizations confirms the predominant orchestration of disappearance as accidentalized war, which extends from clandestine abduction to the covert post-mortem disposition of bodies and remains. Practices and campaigns of enforced or involuntary disappearance are linked to the spatial and visual logic of genocide. Following Hannah Arendt on genocide, enforced disappearance attacks the right to appear on the earth, attacks the right to appear on the earth, and declassifies persons and populations as proper for cohabitation on the terrestrial surface. A nomos of the earth is advanced through enactments that void a right to the earth and to the diversity of cohabitation. In barring the disappeared from the terrestrial surface, the deletion of somatic materiality and biographical gravity, by which the missing becomes politically posthumous and historically anachronistic. Here, the executive power delimits its dominion not over the amassed corporeality of a body politic, nor even the bent backs of the subjugated, but over the ephemeral historical dust and faded footprint of the absentee. Now, genocidal operations can become public events through infrastructural mobilization and official manifestos of national cleansing. In contrast, many regimes of enforced disappearance are frequently accidentalized, randomized, and rendered a-causal by a power committed to the disappearance of its disappearances. Both the missing and the act of vanishment are literally placed under erasure, not completely voided, but subsumed under the quasi-opacity of a retraction that is rescripted as a nondescript mishap inflicted upon those who will henceforth become nondescript. Disappearance and its aftermath can be designed to simulate the extrinsic and non-exemplary accident in order to inhibit the capacity of political and legal witness to catch its causality in the act. As a structuring threshold or borderline event, enforced disappearance as an essential and needful accident overturns the philosophical dicta that the perfection of substance is far more perfect than the objective perfection of the accident. The apparatus of disapparition provisions an alibi or elsewhere for the disappeared by removing any terrestrial trace of the internal deportee and denying any rationality to their abrupt unbecoming. The illogic of the alibi is extended to claims that the disappeared abdicated their lives and their families for an elsewhere where they remain perpetually incommunicado. This is the utopia, the non-place of the disappeared, of their mostly wall-less confinement, a counter-geography of interminable displacement without end. The missing are suspended within the interstitiality of abduction, detention, and decertified death. The regime of vanishment installs a political ecology of mischance through the elaboration of intimidation and symbolic terror by explicit threat and whispered innuendo, which promises further random disapparition to those who speak out and seek out. By instating a public secret, the regime of vanishment simulates a structural indifference and anesthesiology that morbidly envelops the survivor families as much as the disappeared. The affective sensorial experience of survivors of disappearance is excommunicated through cultural anesthesia. The structural stratification of sensory experience, including fear. The police, the public prosecutors, and the courts extend the stigma of culpability to the petitioning families who are criminalized for recalling those who become politically uninheritable. The local community where disappearance occurs responds with a self-protective unknowingness. They forego vocal witnessing as a harbinger of their own eventual vanishing. Only the most stubborn of kin resist this foreclosure, insisting on the living on of the absentee until shown otherwise in the form of a corpse or its fragments. In the exhumations I witnessed in South Africa by the South African Truth Commission, the survivors of the disappeared grasped at any material fragment of usually incinerated remains as a fossil of the withdrawn persona, as if they required not only proof of their abduction and execution, but of a prior life before the spirit was rendered bone. In the documentary film Nostalgia for the Light by Patricio Guzman, a Chilean woman whose brother was abducted by the Pinochet regime searches for decades through the Atacama Desert, where political prisoners were incarcerated and or summarily executed. She eventually recognizes, authenticates, and eulogizes a detached half of a buried foot and sock mummified by desert aridity as belonging to her brother. The disappearance of disappearance captures social torsions that Orlando Patterson associates with slavery, in particular social death and natal alienation, in this case cloaking both the disappeared and their affected families and related survivors. The disappeared and their affected families undergo the contretemps of a living death that, beyond any biological certainty, is a politically enforced de-animation of life without its documented termination. Social death in Patterson is enchained to natal alienation, where the disappeared are forcefully estranged from their birth and all of its biosymbolic nuances that have been explicated by Hannah Arendt. Natal alienation removes the disappeared from the locus of their birth as kin, subjects, and citizens, from their ascendants and descendants, and from the generic biopolitical condition of natio that constitutes the civil subject in the nation state. For Arendt, natality is not just biological, but the ability to bring something new into the world, to initiate the unprecedented and the unrepeated. And this potentiality, too, is denied the disappeared and their stranded survivors. The missing are not only abducted and vanished for what they have done and said, or for who they are, and many times not even that, but for what they can politically become. If unwilled proximity and unchosen cohabitation are preconditions of our political existence, enforced and disavowed disappearance interdicts the possibility of the political through the banishment of present and future political interlocutors from the earth. Is it possible to get some water or something? Intestinal discord. A tropology of devourment haunts a regime of vanishment. This is a militarized cannibalism wherein the disappeared, the event of their disapparition, and the socio-cultural memory of the event are voraciously consumed by an executive power. Disappearance as the intestinal cannibalism of a political order exposes the anthropophagy of the state that's recognized in Thomas Hobbes' discussion of civil war as intestinal discord. Only the cannibal can be truly inhuman in devouring within his species, irrespective of his structural indifference and automated a-causality. The regime of vanishment requires human cogs of inhumanity to advance its veracity for taking names and taking bodies. The Occidental and colonial trope of primitivized cannibalism has been described as the hallucinogenic recreation of the anti-self, the cannibal, in the sovereign subject, but not limited just to the West. This xenophobic mimesis embodies the Occidental fear of being consumed by difference. Enforced disappearance maps and manufactures difference in those it vanishes. Despite its ultimate project of dispersal, it casts its net over time, it casts its nets over time and space in order to grasp, arrest, reduce, and master difference. Can programs of enforced disappearance be construed as a preemptive consumption of difference that is seen as potentially engulfing? Consider its interdiction of natality as a foreclosure of future political interlocutors. It can then be suggested that a regime turns to political cannibalism not only to preemptively consume difference, but to make the difference to which it can be opposed and to be seen to vanquish. The clandestine organization of disappearance is screening behind the accidental and the aleatory, the random, attest to the phobogenic power and privation of a simulacral state that seeks to be insensible, ungraspable, and intangible. This silent, silencing disapparition of force magnifies fear through the expansion of its powers of self-virtualization. The disappeared and the collaterally damaged suffer the mishap of the simulacral, for they carry the virtual death of the structuring enemy, the proper enemy, by becoming that death. What is disappeared or named as collateral damage is a trace of the proper enemy that is erased as that trace. The victims of disappearance and collateral damage constitute the non-arrival of the enemy. They materialize a missive that has missed its mark and illegibility gone astray, scratched out and misaddressed. Here's the postal model of war again. They are the envoys of the unreliable enemy in a state of withdrawal, a postal artifact of war and a dead letter that has been dispatched and canceled in place of the terminal enemy whom the disappeared and collaterally damaged simulate and evoke, and who never appears. The collaterally damaged and the disappear vanished under the inhuman name of the enemy that affects their very being, and yet they are merely the name of that name, which is not a name. A name of a name is not a name. They are rendered ineffable under the inhumanity of a nominal sentencing that befalls them as a accident. The victim targets who have no name, the victim targets who have no part in the enemy are of him by virtue of the accident of a name that is given in their deletion. They are a spun fragment of a name that restages what is not there, the reason and measure of war. They are the non-name of the enemy that their confinement, wounds, and death incarnate and nominate, and thus the disavowed, vanished, and collaterally damaged become unspeakable due to the inflicted accident of the imprisoning name. All names of such targets assigned by war function as accidents, as mishaps, and anachronous inadequations that befall the vanished before and during and after their death. This relates to Sinan's discussion of monstrosity. This suggests that naming is the protological accident, the essential accident, that occurs at and as the inception of war, as the medium of unavoidable, always inadequate identification by which accidentalization is triggered as a sustaining force of war. War as naming begins and lives on in aphoristic certitude. In classical Greek, aphorismos means delimitation. Its etymon, aphorizein, means to define, and horizon, to separate. War as aphorism delivers sentences, abbreviates, underwrites, dissociates, encapsulates, and frames and enables an automatism of the name. It cuts off time and dissects space, for it is, and I'm quoting Derrida one last time, an economy or strategy of mastery that knows very well how to potentialize meaning. It says the truth in the form of the last judgment, and this truth carries death. Thank you.
Sehr geehrte Damen und Herren, großen Dank für das HKW, für die Einladung und großen Dank auch meinen Vorrednern. Ich befürchte, ich werde dem wenig Sinnvolles hinzufügen können. Ich bedanke mich insbesondere für den Hinweis von Herrn Anton auf die enge Allianz zwischen Tiat und amerikanischer Außenpolitik. Ich würde gerne eine Literatur, oder besser gesagt Filmempfehlung dazu geben, um sich dafür zu interessieren, um sich darüber zu informieren, sei dringend Rambo 3 ans Herz gelegt, wo Sylvester Stallone in engster Freundschaft mit den Taliban gegen die Sowjets gekämpft hat, einstmals. Ich muss mich auch entschuldigen, dass der Titel meines Vortrags Angst sehr karg ist. Ich wusste bis gestern noch nicht, worüber ich sprechen würde. Ich würde den Titel gerne noch einmal ändern und jetzt Angstpolitik den Vortrag überschreiben. Nachdem am 20. April 1999 zwei Schüler in bizarrer Aufmachung an der Columbine High School von Littleton, Colorado, 12 Schüler, einen Lehrer und dann sich selbst erschossen hatten, wurde dort nicht nur das Tragen von Trenchcoats verboten und der Schriftsatz der 10 Gebote schulöffentlich ausgehängt. Vielmehr hat man sogleich einige Leitfäden für die Prävention von Schulattacken und das Management bedrohlicher Situationen erarbeitet, in denen Secret Service und Erziehungsministerium eng kooperierten. Die politische Allianz aus Pädagogik, Polizeitaktik und geheimdienstlichem Profiling galt dabei, wie in anderen Fällen dieser Art, dann natürlich auch in Deutschland, jenen besonderen Schauplätzen von Bedrohung und Gefährlichkeit, die sich durch eine recht unbequeme Herausforderung auszeichnen, durch die Aufgabe nämlich, eine systematische Ausrichtung vorbeugender Maßnahmen auf unspezifische Täterprofile, unerkannte Gefährder und künftige, also noch unentdeckte Fälle schädlichen Verhaltens zu leisten. Was in Filmen wie Minority Report von 2002, Sie wissen es, mit Tom Cruise in der Hauptrolle, durch eine behördliche Sonderabteilung namens Pre-Crime, durch präkognitive Verfahren und vor allem durch die hellseherische Begabung sogenannter Pre-Cocks erledigt wurde und zur dauerhaften Sicherungsverwahrung künftiger Täter führte, ist heute zum steinigen Alltag polizeilicher Vorsorge geworden. Schon seit längerem ist damit die wechselseitige Resonanz von unbestimmten Gefahrenlagen und diffusen, weil gegenstandslosen Ängsten zu einem neuen und prominenten Faktor in der politischen Agenda aufgerückt. Während die Angst seit dem 19. Jahrhundert, Herr Scherer hatte darauf hingewiesen, und spätestens seit Kierkegaard als Grundelement und existenzial im Aufbau moderner Subjektformate und ihrer krisenhaften Freiheitsregungen eingezogen war, hat sie nun als Reflektor dezidiert nicht konkreter Bedrohungen einen festen und verlässlichen Posten in den Arrangements zur Verteidigung moderner Gesellschaften erhalten. Weder Gefühl noch Affekt, weder Emotion noch bloße irgendwie persönliche Befindlichkeit funktioniert sie, die Angst, dabei als Operator, als Medium und Koordinate bei der Ausrichtung und Bahnung politischer Entscheidungsprozesse. Sie rechtfertigt also den Titel einer Angstpolitik. Bereits in den 1980er Jahren hatte der Soziologe Niklas Luhmann der Angst, ich zitiere, eine große politische und moralische Zukunft prophezeit und die Größe dieser Zukunft daran erkannt, dass die Angst als das moderne a priori schlechthin allen wissenschaftlichen, technischen und kommunikativen Anstrengungen zu ihrer Auflösung oder Einhegung widersteht. Die Ressource Angst kann rechtlich nicht reguliert, wissenschaftlich nicht widerlegt, diskursiv nicht bestritten werden. Dabei braucht, schrieb Luhmann, Angst gar nicht wirklich vorhanden sein. Angst ist immer authentische Kommunikation, da man sich selbst bescheinigen kann, Angst zu haben, ohne dass andere dies widerlegen können. Angst widersteht jeder Kritik der reinen Vernunft. Soweit Luhmann. Begreift man auf diese Weise Angst nicht als eine psychische Realität, sondern als Passwort politischer Verständigung, so wird damit einerseits ein moralischer Vorzug beansprucht. Denn mit Berufung auf eigene oder fremde Ängste, verbunden mit dem politischen Slogan oder Refrain, den Sie alle kennen, wir müssen die Sorgen und Ängste der Bürger ernst nehmen, also mit Berufung auf eigene und fremde Ängste, macht man es sich zur Pflicht, politische Sorgenfalten aufzuwerfen und gibt sich das Recht, die Anteilnahme an Befürchtungen mit flagranten Maßnahmen zur Gefahrenabwehr zu vergelten. Andererseits aber wird damit ein besonderes, ein spektakuläres Begründungsverfahren reklamiert. Weil die Angst, anders als Furcht, die Ungewissheit von Sachlagen in Angstgewissheit übersetzt, weil also Angst als Motiv sich von allen Begründungen lossagt, kann sie zum Grund politischer Aktionsweisen werden, die sich selbst von der Last ihrer Gründe befreien. Angstpolitik sammelt Angstkapital, nimmt Angstregungen auf oder setzt sie voraus, um mit den in der Angst fehlenden Gründen und Rechtfertigungen sich selbst zu begründen und zu rechtfertigen. Schließlich wird damit ein paradoxer und sich selbst verstärkender Angstkreislauf ausgelöst. Der gebannte Blick auf ungewisse Bedrohungen macht die Ungewissheit von Bedrohungen bedrohlicher. Und wenn man der Angst abzuhelfen versucht, nimmt sie zu. Allenfalls könnte man, wie Luhmann bemerkte, Angst vor der Angst anderer Leute bekommen. Vor diesem Hintergrund lässt sich wohl behaupten, dass Angst ein Prinzip politischer Sinngebung für das bietet, was man moderne Präventionsgesellschaften nennt. Diese Gesellschaften, die sich auf Strafrechtsreformen des 19. Jahrhunderts zurückdatieren und in den gegenwärtigen Debatten um Risikostrafrecht und allgemeinen Präventionsbedarf vollenden, repräsentieren den jüngsten Stand sozialer Modernisierung und zeichnen sich zunächst dadurch aus, dass sich in ihnen der Fokus möglicher Sanktionen von wirklichen Vorfällen auf pure Möglichkeiten verschiebt. Mit Risikostrafrecht und Präventionsperspektiven ist die Gefährlichkeit zu einem Hauptkriterium für die Ausrichtung, für die Formulierung und Ausübung von Rechtsnormen geworden und hat wohl zu einer ebenso epochalen wie unumkehrbaren Wendung im Strafrechtsdenken geführt. Der kritische Blick auf potenziell gefährliche Individuen, die seit den 60er Jahren in den entsprechenden, das heißt kriminologischen Expertisen kursieren, setzt deren Taten nicht nur in die zweite Potenz als potenzielle Gefahren, die selbst also nur möglicherweise gefährlich sind. Dieser Blick wird vielmehr von der Sorge geleitet, dass gerade in den Formen inexpliziten oder unsichtbaren Betragens das Potenzial künftiger Attacken heranwächst. Es geht nicht darum, was man tut oder getan hat, sondern zu welchen Taten man einst fähig gewesen sein wird. Damit haben sich die präventionslogischen Koordinaten von Bedrohung und Gefahrenabwehr als ebenso wirkungsvolle wie unbestimmte Richtwerte für regierungstechnische Maßnahmen erwiesen. Sie zeichnen sich durch eine innere Maßlosigkeit aus. Aus ihnen wird eine soziale Symptomatologie geboren, die den Bezirk des Suspekten und das Erscheinungsfeld von Fear Factors weder sachlich noch systematisch begrenzen kann. Gefährlichkeit wird stets zu wenig bekämpft. Das setzt eine politische Katalyse der Angst in Gang, die mit der Befriedigung von Sicherheitsbedürfnissen Sicherheitsbedürfnisse erzeugt und zur wechselseitigen Steigerung von Gefahrenwahrnehmung und Schutzverlangen führt. Was immer an ängstlichen Regungen zirkuliert und vernehmbar gemacht wird, bietet sich zur systemförmigen Auswertung an und ergibt eine Hypertrophierung von Präventionsapparaten, die selbst wiederum Angstbereitschaften erhöhen. Darum muss der Stimulus beliebiger Ängste vor Überfremdung, vor Eindringlingen, vor schlafenden Terrorzellen oder latenter Gewaltbereitschaft überhaupt weder begründet noch konkretisiert werden, ergibt vielmehr dem Präventionsregime selbst einen verlässlichen sozialen und politischen Grund. Die Zirkulation von Ängsten wurde also systemrelevant. Dabei hat sich diese Angst nicht einfach, wie in der geläufigen Abgrenzung zur Furcht, als objektlos ausgewiesen. Einerseits wird die systemische Angst erhalten und genährt durch all das, was nicht passiert, was sich nicht oder noch nicht konkretisiert. Andererseits tauchen konkrete Objekte oder manifeste Taten nicht als Gründe für Angstregungen auf, sondern als flottierende Beweise dafür, dass die Angst selbst immer schon gut begründet war. Dieser Kreis aus Gefährlichkeit, Präventionsoptik und Angstökonomie hat seinen jüngsten und prägnantesten Niederschlag wohl in einem Gesetzentwurf, ich zitiere, zur effizienteren Überwachung gefährlicher Personen gefunden, der kürzlich von der Regierungspartei in Bayern vorgelegt wurde und der auch für juristische Laien eine bemerkenswerte Lektüre darbietet. Ich kann diese Lektüre nur empfehlen. Denn wenn hier, ich zitiere, die nationale wie internationale Gefährdung durch verschiedene Formen des Terrorismus und Extremismus zum Anlass genommen wird, Gegenstände und Definitionsbereich der Gefährlichkeit neu zu sortieren. Denn einerseits richten sich nun in diesem Entwurf mögliche Gefahren potenzieller Gefährder auf alle möglichen Rechtsgüter, die von Leib und Leben über öffentliche Ordnung und Sicherheit bis zur sexuellen Selbstbestimmung und Eigentum reichen und insgesamt alle, ich zitiere, Sachen von bedeutendem Wert, deren Halt im öffentlichen Interesse dargeboten erscheint, umfassen. Andererseits gelten Präventivmaßnahmen von der elektronischen Fußfessel bis zu einem entfristeten Präventivgewahrsam, auch dann, ich zitiere, wenn sich noch keine konkreten Straftaten einschließlich strafbarer Vortaten gesichert nachweisen lassen. Zitat Ende. Die Sanktionen bleiben nicht, wiederum Zitat, auf das tradierte Modell der Abwehr konkreter, unmittelbar bevorstehender oder gegenwärtiger Gefahren beschränkt. Vielmehr werden die Grenzen, ich zitiere, weitergezogen, die Anforderungen, ich zitiere, an den Kausalverlauf reduziert. Und wiederum, Zitat, ein konkretes Geschehen muss hier noch nicht erkennbar sein, wie es heißt. Der Aspekt der Gefährlichkeit hat sich also von konkreten Gefahren zu drohenden Gefahren verschoben, Das Gefahrenmoment ist wiederum in die zweite Potenz gerückt. Und das heißt, nach diesem Entwurf kann die Polizei notwendige Maßnahmen zur Gefahrenabwehr ergreifen, wenn es Hinweise darauf gibt, dass einmal, ich zitiere, eine Gefahr für die öffentliche Sicherheit und Ordnung entsteht, also eigentlich erst entstehen wird. Das Bestehen einer Gefahr ist einem möglichen Entstehen künftiger Gefahren gewichen. Und das heißt, die noch nicht bestehende Gefahr bringt den Anlass zur Sanktion. Vielleicht lassen sich von hier aus zwei Schlussfolgerungen ziehen. So haben erstens das Präventionsregime, die Systemangst und die Kategorie der Gefährlichkeit das Profil des Gesellschaftsfeindes neu definiert. In präventiver Optik werden die Unterscheidungen von Schuld und Unschuld ebenso wie die alten humanistischen Posten von Vorsatz, Zurechnung, Verantwortlichkeit durch eine Skala des Gefährlichen ersetzt, die sich auf die Intensität von Bedrohungen sozialer und politischer Sicherheitslagen bezieht. Damit rücken einerseits jene mäßig sozialisierenden Exemplare in den Blick, die sich durch eine mindere Loyalität gegenüber basalen Bedingungen von Gesellschaftlichkeit und den Normen sozialer Verträglichkeit auszeichnen. Hier greift der jüngere, im Augenblick sehr akute und vage Begriff, Sammelbegriff der Soziopathie. Andererseits wurde damit ein Unschärfebereich erzeugt, wenn man so will, es wurde dieser Unschärfebereich konsequent erzeugt, der die möglichen Taten gefährlicher Individuen in gleitenden Übergängen zwischen Verbrechen, Wahnsinnsaktionen und Attentat lokalisiert. Verwirrte Schüler, Amokläufer, blitzkonvertierte Messerstecher, sinistre Migranten oder Terrorverdächtige kommen nun aus demselben Aufenthalt in der Latenz und finden ihren gemeinsamen Nenner allenfalls darin, dass sich in ihnen mehr oder weniger große Bedrohungen des Sozialen, eben Gesellschaftsfeindschaft, regt. So wenig dabei der Unterschied von innerer oder äußerer Feindschaft noch einen triftigen Sinn macht, so sehr wurde im Zeichen des allgemeinen Alarmismus der Terror selbst zu einer zerfließenden Kategorie. Nicht zuletzt deshalb, weil sich in ihm die effizienteste Symbiose mit den Sicherheitsbedenken des Präventionsregimes artikuliert. Der sogenannte Terrorismus mag nach landläufiger Meinung auf die Produktion von Ängsten abzielen. Vor allem aber attackiert er stets auf einer Ebene, auf der man den Anspruch erhebt, für Sicherheit zu sorgen. Das unterscheidet den Terrorismus von allen anderen Formen der Kriminalität. Sicherheit und Unsicherheit sind hier keine Gegensätze, sie umreißen vielmehr eine sich ausweitende Zone, die Auskunft darüber gibt, wie sich in unseren Gesellschaften das Wechselverhältnis von Ordnungsbegehren und transgressiven Zumutungen organisiert. Somit ist der gegenwärtige Terror gerade in seiner Beliebigkeit prägnant, sofern er direkt auf das Versagen von Prophylaxen, Präventionsstrategien und Interventionstaktiken gerichtet ist. Zweitens hat sich im Zeichen von Präventionsgesellschaften, also unseren Präventionsgesellschaften, im Zeichen von Gefahrenmanagement und Angstkommunikation der Gesellschaftsvertrag neu konstelliert. Er hat sich zu Sicherheitsverträgen verschoben, die auf einer Art Emissionshandel mit Angstderivaten beruhen und zur punktuellen Abgabe von Rechten wie Datenschutz, Fernmeldegeheimnis, Unverletzlichkeit der Wohnung etc. im Tausch mit Sicherheitsversprechen aufrufen. Das prägt die politische Dimension der Systemangst. Hier wird die Angstbesetzung von Unsicherheitsreservaten in die Angstpolitik der Gefahrenabwehr konvertiert, Angstbereitschaft also in das Verlangen verwandelt, besser, sicherer, fürsorglicher regiert zu werden. Man könnte dabei vom phobogenetischen Charakter bestimmter Machtformen sprechen, wie Alan Feldman das gerade vorgeführt hat. Wenn es sich aber dabei tatsächlich um eine Ausweitung von Angstzonen handelt, die sich mit einem Rückzug von Rechtsgarantien deckt, das Recht reicht eben nicht hin, Sicherheitsbedürfnisse zu befriedigen, dann muss man wohl daran erinnern, dass der Einzug und die Wirksamkeit der Angst in den Binnenraum politischer Macht stets mit der Sache der Tyrannis und der Position des Tyrannen verbunden war. Hannah Arendt hat das einst konstatiert und die Zirkulation von Angst und Furcht als Prinzip und, ich zitiere, Grundtatsache der Tyrannis namhaft gemacht. Dabei geht es hier also allerdings nicht darum, einen neuen Despoten oder die gespenstische Wiederkehr des Totalitären zu beschwören. Wenn Angst und Furcht nach Arendt tatsächlich ein antipolitisches Prinzip innerhalb des politischen Bereichs darstellen, so liegt das darin, dass sich in ihnen Ohnmachtserfahrungen mit Herrschaftsbegehren verbünden und den Charakter des politischen Handelns als Handeln in Gemeinschaft, als Acting in Concert unterminieren. Furcht und Angst generieren, ich zitiere Arendt, einen Willen zur Macht in der Ohnmacht, das heißt einen Willen zu herrschen oder den Willen beherrscht zu werden. Zitat Ende. Die Ausweitung von Angstzonen fällt mit einem Wuchern polizeilicher Sicherheitsdispositive zusammen. Das ist, glaube ich, die tyrannische Selbstaufgabe demokratischer Politik. Ich bedanke mich für Ihre Geduld.
So, first of all, thank you very much for this wonderful presentations. We go on with the discussion here in English, and then after a while, we open the floor to you for questions. All of you, in one way or the other, described in a very convincing way how the politics of fear are undergirding democratic institutions and really converting democracy in a kind of new state. My question is, in the dynamics from the state perspective, my question is, are we in that sense in a very specific historical situation, or does not this logic have been the case all the times? Looking at McCarthy era in the 50s in the United States, looking, for example, in the 70s in Germany, how the state was fighting the students and later on the Red Army fraction. So is that not a kind of constitutive politics of states all the time? And what is the specific of the this historical moment?
The answer is yes.
Is this on?
Yes. Yes and no. If we look at the formation of war, of a polemological state since the end of World War II, there are certain factors that have emerged that are different. World War II in the United States was the last war of national mobilization. War becomes now fought by selected aspects of the state, always undeclared, and so large populations are not affected by it, as we see, as I discussed in my opening paper. They were living the time of war as a time out of time. There has been also a civilianization of war, where the distinction between combatants and non-combatants has been completely and utterly voided, and certainly one could see antecedents in World War II, if not World War I. There's also been the eradication of a discrete battlefield where war takes place, where there are two opposing armies. Thirdly or fourthly, there's what I call the containerization of war, which is analogous to capitalist containerization, where, you know, capitalist companies will offshore their locations in order to escape legal and moral and media accountability. And the state is doing the same thing. It's offshoring sovereignty, making it a very decentralized form of power, and which is epitomized by the kind of multiple apparatuses of sovereignty that are represented by robotic drone weapons, right, that inflict capital punishment based on algorithmic patterns.
probably where I might differ with Professor Vogel is that I don't see the state as functionalistic as maybe he has described it, and we can debate that, because I tend to agree with Derrida that we have a state now that is invested in what Derrida called an autoimmune disorder. He talked about what happens when democracy attacks itself to protect democracy. And part of that autoimmune disorder is the erasure of its enactment of violence, its stratification of the witnessing of violence. So war now, for me, from my perspective, from a mediological perspective, becomes a war against the witnessing of war, which limits democratic accountability, where I do converge with Professor Vogel.
Probably I should make a short remark. So I think there's a very unequal distribution of fear in politics. To give a simple example, it would have been very reasonable to have fear before going into the Iraq war. It's very interesting. So nobody had fear beginning this war. You can tell a story about that. So it's maybe reasonable to have fear or even anxiety for doing disasters like that. Second point, and this is a short answer to your remark, what I was interested in is a systemic fear or systemic anxiety, which is linked to a special kind of contemporary society, which means preventive or preemptive societies. This means that if a society like ours deals with unclear dangers, with things which did not yet happen, this has a certain mirror in fear and in anxiety. So anxiety becomes systematically relevant. And this is a new situation. And this is not the situation of fear in totalitarian societies or in tyrannic societies. It's another kind of systemic fear, which must not be felt by you or by me, but which is a sort of password of communication.
I just want to make two brief remarks that, of course, there are continuities and discontinuities. Perhaps what marks the war on terror, and this has been mentioned by a lot of folks, including Talal Asad, is that I think it's the first time where the war is not against a sovereign, it's not against the Soviet Union or a state, it's against a method. So as he says, how will this war end? Who will raise the white flag and say, I give up? That's the difference. The other thing, just to problematize your question a little bit, is that it seems that the concern is that the erosion of the institutions of liberal democracy. But what some of us are trying to say is that it's the supposed well-being of liberal democracies that has produced the conditions that have gotten us here, in a way, produced the conditions for the proliferation of terrorism.
It's very interesting that the war against Iraq was declared as a preemptive war, a preventive war. This means a war which should eliminate terror. And this was the original scene of our modern and contemporary terror.
So you would argue that the politics of fear is, so to say, inbuilt in our understanding of liberal democracies. Because you come to a point where on the subject level, what Josef Vogel was explaining, if I refer to my emotions, to my fear, I don't have to legitimize myself anymore. And this is, of course, if in liberal democracies, so to say, the subjective perspective is at the heart of decision-making, then you have exactly this situation.
I would just add to that, and in Sinan's presentation, his discussion of monstrosity, the sovereign state is legitimating itself in the figure of the monster, or the Schmittian enemy, if you want to talk. And that sovereignty has no. If we look at what happens from 1989 onward, the loss of a bipolar world, the emergence of a multipolar world, which corresponds to the multipolarity of enemies, which the sovereign state now reproduces itself and archives itself in this figure of the transmissible, but always slightly nomadic, slightly peripatetic, slightly, as Derrida calls them, unreliable enemy that always is to be substituted. And just one brief comment. I agree with a lot of what Professor Vogel said, he describes the medicalization of the state, so the issue of preemption, right? The health of the state, preemptive health. But then we have to begin to explain the pathologization of that medicalized state and the type of, you know, the notion of collateral damage, the fact that that medicalized state renders certain bodies expendable and disposable in its auto-medicalization.
Just a very brief point. I mean, also, I think we have to be mindful as to when, what kind of narrative and history of terrorism are we speaking of? So terrorism becomes a problem in the West only when its victims become the citizens of liberal democracies. After the end of Afghanistan, terrorism claimed thousands of lives in the Arab world when the Mujahideen that were supported by Western countries returned to Egypt and Algeria and massacred thousands of people. But that terrorism was, this is what we have to confront. It's when does terrorism become a global problem? Is that when it starts to claim in massive numbers citizens of liberal democracies? But when terrorism is operating out there, it's not really a global problem. It's only when it circulates and comes home then it becomes a global problem.
I simply wanted to add, and probably Mr. Anton knows it better than me, that there was another original scene of this terrorism which happened in Indonesia in the 60s, where United States supported Islamic warfare, jihad, against the socialist government, and this was the first major massacre in after Second World War history. And there is a certain destiny that the specter of terrorism financed by United States comes back.
I want to bring in another actor in this whole game, because up to now we basically spoke about the state, but there is another sphere to the whole, let's say, politics of war. It's the economy, because there's a whole, you mentioned that slightly in your talk, there's a whole economy around the idea of fear and security, of course, on the other side, from insurance companies up to agencies which provide safety to special people, to also even in the Middle East, Western private agencies providing security to one extent or the other. So how is this economy of fear related to the politics of fear?
Well, as Nancy and others have discussed, this whole notion of disaster accumulation, where basically corporations and the state accrue surplus value from disaster, either in its projection or its actual enactment or in its aftermath. I think there's also a moral economy of surplus accumulation. Before I left, I read an article by an American psychologist that says the problem with American public culture and past British and French public culture is that we all become terrorphobes. We fear terror, which is basically the equivalent of saying we fear fear. And we have to master our fear of terror, which is to say we have to master our fear of fear. And I began thinking that, well, if you translate this in Foucauldian terms, Foucault talked about the government of self and others, and he argued that before one can govern others, we have to learn to govern ourselves. So now it seems we have to master our fear of fear before we can circulate fear globally and project it around the world. This is the new American moral economy, which has its parallels in the capitalist economy as well, in the notion of mastering derivatives, predictive algorithms that are focused on pattern recognition and anomaly detection. And that is a common point of intersection between capitalist prediction and drone prognostics. Identify the pattern, whether it's normal or abnormal, and then to normalize the whole practice of anomaly detection, and not only to eradicate the anomaly, but to use the anomaly as surplus value to reproduce your power in time and space.
May I add something concerning the relationship between fear and economics? I think we should at first concede that something like insurance companies is a very interesting and very friendly invention, because insurances are transforming dangers in risks, and risk can be calculated, and if you can calculate something, it's a minimization of fear. But there's another effect of our contemporary economy, that for some people, especially in lower classes, this system, this capitalist system, is transforming risk once again into danger. If you lose your job, if you lose your house, if you lose finally your social life. So this is a culture of fear in modern contemporary capitalism, where capitalism cannot really tame the risk and transforms it for some classes into danger.
You want to write? Okay, so I open now to the floor. If there are questions from the floor, we have mics because we provide translation. So you can ask in German or in English, whatever you want. I should have prepared you for this crucial time. Yes.
May I ask something to Mr.
Yes.
Anton?
Okay. It's time for to think. Yeah.
No. Concerning your talk and your novel and poetry. Did CIA ever contact you to help?
That's an excellent question. I was contacted to go to Washington and provide cultural training for people who were going to go to... That's the other thing. That's why I'm haunted by this issue of culture. Because largely in the U.S. there is this still, even after everything until now, there has yet to be a wide-ranging recognition of not just the catastrophe of the war, the catastrophe of the logic of going to war. So we forget now, but most people who became against the war not because they realized the catastrophic, racist, whatever, it's because it's about efficiencies, that, well, we didn't have the information, we didn't go. So the thinking is that you just need more information to be culturally sensitive, to know how to deal with the Iraqis so that they would accept colonialism. And I mean, there was a controversy about using all these anthropologists by the Pentagon and others. So I was contacted, and ironically, I was contacted by an Iraqi American who was clueless, but she told me, but you know, this will help, you know, make things better. But this is an industry, of course, of native informants around Washington, D.C. and elsewhere. And I was contacted again by NBC or CBS to go, I mean, it's grotesque, to help point out on the map for their viewers where the bombing is going to take place. And, you know, I mean, they were very innocent. They just thought that this is a very neutral activity. Why wouldn't I want to point out where things are being bombed in my hometown? So, and it has happened even more frequently to other people I know. Thank you for the question.
Is there now a question? Because then I have a last point before we close the session.
Everything is illuminated. There are no questions.
Yeah, but I have one. Or I have a point, with a question to it. Related to the topic we have, there was a very interesting case in Germany, and I elaborate a little bit for the non-Germans in the audience, which is the NSU case, where a neo-Nazi group of three people basically were killing people from the Turkish community over several years, and the police were searching for the perpetrators, but they were not searching in the neo-Nazi context. They were searching amongst the Turkish community because they thought it's a kind of mafia situation going on within the community. So what the logic behind this was that the NSU, the neo-Nazi group, was really calculating that the terror they produce by killing people was added by the state and terrorizing then the communities. So my question is, knowing the games you were describing here, is this also, or have you other cases where third parties are using the logics of these games in order to take advantage of it?
You know, there was the case of an Israeli blogger, internet troll, who basically sent threatening letters to synagogues in the United States and Europe, attempting to steer and manipulate hostile attacks on local Muslim communities as a source of those threats. He's an Israeli Jew, or an Israeli American Jew. But these are symptomatic for me in the sense that people who can develop this kind of false information or disinformation campaigns know that the state is addicted to fear. The state is addicted to finding a reliable enemy, and that we have to understand that the functionality of preemption is really secondary to the making known and the showing of power through the capacity to identify who is or who is not the terrorist. And I really think that, to go back to your original question, one of the shifts in the formation of state power is semiotic, in the sense that the state is now the master not only of making fear appear or the fearsome appear, but also deciding when that which is threatening should not appear. So, for example, in the United States, since 2001, the vast majority of acts that are classified as terrorism have been committed by what's now called the alt-right, not by Muslims or not any by anybody or Arabs, anybody in the name of some jihadist ideology. And even that statistic is adumbrated by the fact that it doesn't include school shootings and doesn't include attacks on abortion clinics. So there are certain casualties that really get rendered invisible, written off the books. So certain acts of violence and certain lives count while others remain uncountable. And this, again, is the power of the state to make appear or to make disappear, which goes back to my original theme.
Before we started, Josef Vogel asked me when we are going to be ready, and I said around 9:15, 9:20, and the reason for his question was he needed a cigarette. Now he gets a cigarette at 9 o'clock already. Thank you very much. Last question. Okay, last question.
I've lost my fear.
Ah, okay.
I'm wondering, it's a fascinating discussion, and thank you all for your research and your poetry. I just wonder a little if this discourse around fear isn't a way of not facing the real issue, which is bullying. What made me think of that was the Columbine example, but also some of the things that Sinan was saying in terms of, just some of your comments, that saying that the fear is the organizing principle of power now and these kinds of things, isn't the real problem force and violence by the state? I think that's my question. And that the fear discourse hides this.
Well, if you go back to Thomas Hobbes' discussion of Leviathan, which is based on a model of pastoral power, where the sovereign basically guards the health and security of the citizen subjects who have contracted for that service. Part and parcel of that service is not only the repulsion, identification and repulsion of external enemies, but the sovereign is given the right to punish internal enemies. And there is no state apparatus, and there is no apparatus of sovereignty that is not founded on force, founded on the kind of primordial, originary monopolization of the right to use violence. And you really cannot speak of the Western concept of the state, both in its colonial and post-colonial formations, both the First World and the Global South, because that concept of the state still exists. It also extends to the Global South, that is not grounded on
the law of force and the force of law. So here we have to think about the categories of Walter Benjamin in the famous Critique of Violence, where he talks about two forms of violence. There is law-conserving violence, which is the violence that Althusser associated with the repressive apparatuses, that, you know, the law, the prison system, the army, that uses violence to conserve so-called legal structures. And then the notion of a law-founding violence or a law-constituting violence, where the state steps outside of his existing legal structures to found itself. And all revolutionary states are predicated on a law-founding violence. And insofar that it founds or constitutes law, it is a violence that occurs outside of law, outside of any legal order, and is only retrospectively legitimized once it institutes a legal order by that legal order. So there's a kind of tautological circularity to the kind of mystical authority of law that Benjamin was pointing out in that famous essay.
Simply, I agree completely with Ellen, and simply wanted to add, and this was a question of violence, even state violence. I think we see since the 90s a very clear progression, even progress, in enforcement of securities. And at the same time, minimization of liberties and rights. And I think this is one of the most interesting movements, one of the most interesting developments in our societies. It's modernization of our societies, minimizing laws, rights, and liberties, and maximizing securities. And there's a second remark which could be interesting concerning fear, but probably also concerning this special kind of fear, like anxiety. There are American jurists, lawyers, who say that anxiety creates something like probability neglect. So if anxiety rules in societies, you have a feeling which does not at all correspond to statistics, to probabilities. And this creates a completely queer political perspective. This is one of the reasons why anxieties are so bad advisor, political advisor.
Basically, they create a totalitarian situation where there is no outside, because it's completely defining the situation.
Not totalitarian. I wouldn't say that, because totalitarian state needs fear, real fear. That means a totalitarian state is a state who makes all the citizen equal. It makes all citizen equal because of terror, of state terror. Our societies have a much more interesting, disintegration. So anxiety, for example, leads that you can exclude some groups, for example, refugees or Muslims, etc. It's a completely different form of discrimination. It's not totalitarian.
But the kind of development of xenophobia entails a lot of disconnection, because the ideology of Syrian refugees landing on the shores of the Mediterranean or drowning in the ocean is completely obscured by the fact that the European countries that are either offering them hospitality or hostility, also many of them are supplying armaments to those states who are bombing in Syria, creating displaced populations. But that kind of kill chain, this is a kind of drone weaponry jargon, is erased, so that the appearance out of nowhere of the refugee or the asylum seeker automatically renders him or her a phobogenic object, because the causality has been eradicated or erased or anesthetized in the public culture of the so-called host society. So they appear out of nowhere. And I think here the discussion of Foucault, and going back to Sinan's point on the monster, Foucault had this notion of where the pre-modern period was characterized by monsters of form, I think you described a bit of that. You know, the figure of the Muslim as not fully human and having other non-human or extra-human attributes. And then he characterized modernity, particularly psychiatric modernity, as focused, shifting the focus away from monsters of form to monsters of behavior. But I think what we have today in terms of phobogenesis is the resynthesis of monsters of form in terms of racism, you know, Orientalism, and monsters of behavior in the figure of the mole-like, secretive, sleeper terrorist who's hidden. I mean, if you look at the torture that took place in Abu Ghraib, there was an attempt by the American guards there to actually make the terrorist appear on the surface of the prisoner's body. They didn't know who these men were. They didn't know why they had been consigned to Abu Ghraib. And so the whole practice of torture, abuse, and pornographic simulation was basically an attempt to make the terrorist appear, to produce and generate the terrorist that exists below the surface of these Iraqi bodies. And this was done through kind of penetration of the bodily orifices by various, techniques of abuse and insult and injury, but also through a visual culture of trying to make the invisible visible. So we have to understand, for example, we're going to talk about force and violence and bullying, that the camera, the images that were taken at Abu Ghraib were not reportage. They were an extensions of the practice of torture. They were prosthetic invasions and penetrations of the body of the prisoners who were camouflaging the hidden terrorists that had to be brought to the surface, very much in the way that Sinan describes that the grave will eventually read the true nature of the corpse. And these were living corpses, and their prison apparatus in which they were confined is somewhat equivalent to the grave that reads the true essence of those bodies. Now, to take it place in terms of the internal population, all of us, through insurance, through medical practices, have to show that we have a body that abjures risk, and only a body that abjures risk is worthy of being part of the body politic.
I just want to add briefly, in the American context, because what I see is often, well, in the U.S. or here, is the disconnect when citizens look at what is happening abroad, the disconnect with what is happening abroad, and again, foreign policy, and if we speak in this country and the way it supplies weapons to Saudi Arabia, for example. But to go back to Abu Ghraib, in that the practices that were no longer permissible inside the United States by law, but they could be permissible abroad. So it was astonishing to me that many people did not see the similarity between photographing lynchings and how lynchings were spectacles that white families took their children to and took pictures of the lynching and sent them as postcards. And in my classrooms, none of the students could see, even with the prodding, that there is any connection between what happens in the metropolis and what happens in the colony. But I think the gentleman's question is that while, of course, we should never be naive about violence and how it's constitutive, but I think there is a danger also of mystifying many of these categories in a way of overanalyzing them so that they become ungraspable in a way.
I think this should be the last word. Thank you very much, all of you here on the stage, and thank you very much for coming, and have a good evening. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.